The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled A Clinical Compass for Selecting the Sequencing HER2 Targeting Therapies in HER2 Positive Metastatic Breast Cancer, an update on the latest evidence, guidelines, and expert insights. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/MVX860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this program, A Clinical Compass for Selecting and Sequencing HER2 Targeted Therapies in HER2 Positive Metastatic Breast Cancer. We're going to be reviewing an update on the latest evidence guidelines, and I'll be providing my insights. My name is Dr. Reshma Mattani. I'm Chief of Breast Medical Oncology at Miami Cancer Institute, Baptist Health, South Florida, and I am pleased to be with you here today. So here are our goals. I hope at the end of this program, I'll have helped you augment your knowledge of the current and evolving role of the new treatments and some of our existing therapies that we've utilized for HER2-positive breast cancer, and that you'll be equipped with skills to optimally integrate these agents into developing an individualized treatment plan and selecting and sequencing these therapies throughout the disease continuum for your patients in clinic. So let's start with module one. We'll go through what we're calling a toolkit for HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer. And here in this session, we'll be focusing on the latest evidence and guidelines. I think it's always useful as we discuss HER2 positive disease to sort of take a big step back and look at the progress that we've made. And you'll notice that this is a very busy slide, which is good news for our patients because it means that we have considerably expanded the armamentarium of agents for the treatment of HER2 positive disease. And you see the general classes of these therapies illustrated for you in this graphic. On the top upper left-hand side, you'll notice that there are monoclonal antibodies detailed. Of course, we're all very familiar with trastuzumab, the first treatment that we had targeting this subtype of breast cancer. We also have pertuzumab, and then more recently, margetuximab, the Fc-engineered monoclonal antibody. You'll notice these therapies are larger. They work on the outside of the cell. We have smaller molecules like tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are detailed for you on the bottom left-hand side. These drugs work inside the cell. And then, of course, we have our new class of therapies, antibody drug conjugates. These are targeted delivery agents of cytotoxic chemotherapy directly targeting a specific antigen, in this case, HER2, on the surface of these cancer cells. And you'll notice now that we have antibody drug conjugates approved and many in the pipeline, so to speak. And there are more therapies to come, including bispecific antibodies, vaccines, CAR T cell therapy. We'll be talking about some of these in detail later in the session, where we'll review novel treatments that are in development. All of these therapies ultimately are working to impact proliferation, survival, and angiogenesis, and of course, ultimately result in cell death. So at last count, we have 8 approved therapies and hopefully more to come. Again, speaking to the progress that we've made in targeting HER2. So with that in mind, let's now move into a discussion of what standard first-line therapy for metastatic breast cancer would be, and that is dual monoclonal antibody treatment with pertuzumab and trastuzumab in combination with chemotherapy. And we are now shown here the long-term survival that we see, the end of study results of the pivotal CLEOPATRA study, which looked at adding pertuzumab to this backbone of trastuzumab and a taxane. And what you see here is a pretty significant improvement in median progression-free survival of 18.7 months associated with the pertuzumab arm, as well as an improvement in overall survival, 57.1 months again. And what I'll just draw to your attention here as we look at these curves is a couple things. One, please remember this median PFS of 18.7 months in the first line with our standard treatment, because we'll come back to that and put it in context to some of the newer data that we have with an antibody drug conjugate. The other thing I'll call out here is there is about 15 to 16% tail on this curve as far as, you know, the number of patients that are still doing well and alive and progression free at this time point. And what that kind of alludes to is this thought that are there a certain subpopulation of metastatic breast cancer patients who are potentially curable and are doing very, very well long term? Again, speaking to some of the newer approaches that are being investigated, and we'll circle back to that later as well. Now, beyond first line, as we think of second line therapy after standard treatment, which now includes pertuzumab, but many of these trials looked at patients that had had prior taxane and trastuzumab, we start to have discussions regarding a newer novel type of treatment, an antibody drug conjugate. And the first one that we had available was T-DM1. Now, T-DM1 is an antibody drug conjugate that has an antimicrotubule inhibitor as the chemotherapy payload, as you see here in this table that summarizes the attributes of these two ADCs. The newer generation ADCs, of which TDXD or trastuzumab deruxtecan is our newer drug, you see the topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, so a different payload here. You'll also notice differences in the drug-to-antibody ratio, with TDXD having many more molecules per antibody, so 8-to-1 as compared to 3.5 to 1 with T-DM1, and then differences in the cleavability of the linker, which then relates to the ability of that chemotherapy payload to drift out of the cancer cell to other cells that are expressing lower levels of the target, HER2, and has led to an approval in HER2-low disease for TDXD, where we don't see that with T-DM1. So here's progress here in targeting HER2 with antibody drug conjugates. Now, as I mentioned, T-DM1 was our first antibody drug conjugate that we had available, and it used to be standard second line therapy for the majority of our patients based on the Amelia trial. But this study, the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, changed that paradigm, because here we had a head-to-head comparison of these two antibody drug conjugates, TDXD versus T-DM1. These were patients that had previously been treated with trastuzumab and taxane in the advanced or metastatic setting. And you'll notice that there was a stratification based on hormone receptor status, prior treatment with pertuzumab. About two-thirds of patients had prior pertuzumab, and of course, a history of visceral disease, with the primary endpoint here being progression-free survival. So I asked you to remember that 18-month median PFS in the CLEOPATRA trial, because what we saw here in a later line setting was a median PFS of 28.8 months with TDXD, as compared to 6.8 months with trastuzumab emtansine or T-DM1. So I think that really is really remarkable when you think of how we usually see efficacy play out. There's this concept of the law of diminishing returns, right? Usually you see your most effective treatments giving you the longest progression-free survival first line, and then you see that dwindle with time. But here we see a highly active agent in the second line setting, giving us this really long median PFS, which sort of gives us a hint of what we may see in the future as we use this treatment earlier on. The other thing that I'll just point out is, if you look at the T-DM1 arm, 6.8 months, that's a little bit less robust than what we saw in the Amelia trial that I had mentioned. And this is a slide that actually summarizes some of the other agents in the setting of prior taxane and trastuzumab therapy. And of course, you know, T-DM1 in that Amelia trial, we saw about 9.6 months. Of course, you know, the DB03 trial I mentioned, those patients had prior treatment with pertuzumab, and that may have influenced how that T-DM1 arm did. The other point I'll make with this slide is, looking at some of the other available agents, you see that bar being so much higher with TDXD of 28.8 months, really outperforming many of the other therapies that are available in these patients in this setting. So on that basis, you know, we're really kind of betting on this trial showing that T-DXd in the first line setting may have a role. And I don't think it is a huge gamble to suspect that we will see one of the T-DXd arms being the winner, so to speak, here. And what does that mean for the future as we think of using this agent either alone in combination with pertuzumab, depending on, you know, what the data are as they get presented? Well, for certain patients, it may be a useful strategy, but quality of life really is very important here. And we know usually when we give the Cleopatra regimen and then drop that taxane and continue monoclonal antibody therapy alone, many patients are feeling very well. So how will that factor into to the treatment selection? That remains to be seen. And of course, will be dependent on the individual patient, and of course, the efficacy data. As we look at the efficacy or the toxicity data in DB03, you see here summarized the most common treatment emergent adverse events in 20% or more of patients. And as we have utilized this therapy more and more now, we see that there are some hematologic issues that are highlighted here, but the main issue is really nausea. And I think in my practice, I've been very successful in handling that with the use of appropriate antiemetics. Patients tend to do very well. You can get that under control. It is important to point out the risk of alopecia with T-DXd. And in terms of T-DM1, as we've utilized this ADC for many years, we know that it can have some toxicity with regards to AST, ALT elevation, and thrombocytopenia as well. So this is a really important adverse event to highlight with T-DXd, ILD pneumonitis. And in prior trials, there were some grade 5 events, meaning deaths. So this is something that we all have to be very mindful of when we think of utilizing this agent. In the DB03 trial, you'll notice that there were no grade 4 or 5 ILD pneumonitis events, but all grade ILD in the T-DXd arm was about 15%. What I think it's important to just highlight here is here's where we really need to pay attention to patients, their symptoms, and educating them about potential signs and symptoms of this side effect. And we'll talk a bit later in the program about monitoring for ILD and how we can incorporate CT scans and things of that sort to hopefully catch this early so that patients are recovering and able to do well on this highly effective treatment. So what about beyond a second line? So most of these trials now looking at third line therapy and beyond are in patients that have had prior exposure to T-DM1. And this single arm phase 2 study, the DESTINY-Breast01 study, was our first trial with T-DXd that actually led to approval of this therapy. And that was on the basis of this really robust and exciting waterfall plot that I think has left an indelible impression in everyone's mind. You see each of those downward bars representing a patient responding, and the response rate of 60.9% was really remarkable to see in this heavily pretreated population. Remember, all these patients had been exposed to T-DM1, so we see here the activity of this ADC in patients that have had exposure to T-DM1 and led to accelerated approval in December of 2019. And then we saw this data, the DESTINY-Breast02 study. At this point, we were already utilizing T-DXd even in the second line because the DB03 trial, which I had shown you earlier, that head-to-head comparison firmly planted T-DXd as our second line choice. But this trial was required to be done, the randomized study, again, looking at patients that had previous exposure to T-DM1 and were then randomized to TDXD versus treatment of physician's choice. And no surprises here to see TDXD perform really well, better than treatment of physician's choice, which here included trastuzumab capecitabine or lapatinib capecitabine. You see an improvement in progression-free and overall survival associated with the TDXD arm. Now, moving on to another type of therapy, HER2-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors. In that cartoon that we started with, we talked about these molecules being smaller drugs that work intracellularly, and our first available TKI was lapatinib. You'll notice that here, as shown in this graphic, it targets HER1 and HER2. Neratinib, the pan-HER2 inhibitor, targets HER1, HER2, and HER4. And you see the difference here with tucatinib, which has high specificity to HER2 receptors compared to lapatinib and neratinib, which again also bind to those other HER receptors. And here, without having the target of EGFR, it may have impacted some of the EGFR-mediated side effects that we see with other TKIs, specifically lapatinib as compared, lapatinib and neratinib as compared to tucatinib. Now, as we think of neratinib, some of us have some familiarity with this drug already, as it's approved in the extended adjuvant setting as well for high-risk early-stage patients. This trial was a phase 3 study that led to the expanded indication of neratinib in the metastatic setting in combination with capecitabine. The NALA trial, this was a comparison of neratinib plus cape versus lapatinib plus cape. And what we saw here was an improvement in mean progression-free survival on the order of about 2 months, but no overall survival benefit. And you know, we'll come back to the tyrosine kinase inhibitor options that we have, but I think in my practice, I have a hard time justifying the use of neratinib when we have other drugs like tucatinib available, especially based on the toxicity profile as compared to tucatinib as well. So speaking of tucatinib, now we move into this really important trial, the HER2CLIMB study. This was a very large randomized study where we looked to see the addition or the impact of the addition of tucatinib to this backbone of trastuzumab and capecitabine. These were patients that had all had prior exposure to trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and T-DM1. And what was really unique about this study was the fact that the investigators allowed patients on with brain metastases, which in other studies have routinely included patients with stable brain metastases, but here patients even with active or unstable brain mets. So everyone had a baseline brain MRI, and there were some patients found without a prior history of brain mets to have brain metastases, as long as they were 2 centimeters or less, not requiring immediate local therapy, or had progression of known brain metastases. These were considered active brain mets, and these patients would have not been enrolled on other trials, but were permitted to enroll here. 2-to-1 randomization as shown, and the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, secondary endpoint overall survival. And what we saw was an improvement in both progression-free and overall survival, about a 5.5-month improvement in overall survival in the updated follow-up, and an improvement also in progression-free survival, the hazard ratio of 0.57, again, favoring the incorporation of tucatinib. Now, more recently at San Antonio, we heard the HER2CLIMB-2 study, and these were results that were just recently presented. This was a randomized phase 3 placebo-controlled trial evaluating whether adding tucatinib to T-DM1 improved outcomes for patients with HER2-positive metastatic disease after trastuzumab and a taxane in any setting. importantly, in this trial, patients were allowed on, even again, if they had brain mets, even if they were a stable, progressing, or even previously untreated brain mets. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival by investigator assessment, and there was a hierarchical statistical design here such that if the primary analysis for PFS was positive, that would trigger the first of two interim overall survival analyses. I should mention that in terms of patient characteristics, baseline demographics, these were fairly well balanced. I won't be showing you this information. It is notable that about 44% of patients enrolled did have brain metastases, and half of those had active brain metastases, and the median prior number of prior therapies was one. Patients had not had prior exposure to T-DXd, which is really important, and about 90% of these patients did have prior pertuzumab. So what did we see in terms of the efficacy? We saw that the addition of tucatinib to T-DM1 significantly improved median PFS. You see the absolute improvement was about 2 months, hazard ratio of 0.76. And because of the hierarchical statistical testing design, it wasn't possible to statistically test the benefit of in patients with brain mets. But however, what the investigators saw was a very strong trend in favor of the tucatinib arm. And here you see the hazard ratio of 0.64. In terms of overall survival, because the primary analysis was statistically significant, this did prompt the first interim analysis of OS. It's important to point out here that this was an immature analysis. There was only 53% of overall survival events that were observed at the time of the analysis. And there was no statistically significant difference in overall survival between the two arms at this early time point. I'll just point out, as you look at this curve, you'll notice that up to about 18 months, the overall survival curves completely overlap. But again, remember the data are very immature here. There are only about 2 years of median follow-up in patients, and there was a lot of censoring that happened after that 18-month time point, which may explain why those curves started to cross over. So we really do need to wait for additional follow-up here to understand the true survival benefit, if there is one, to this approach. So as we finish up, just some final comments on HER2CLIMB-2. I think it's really an important trial because it is another look at this highly active agent, tucatinib. It's the second large randomized trial to show a benefit to incorporating tucatinib to standard systemic therapy. And also, very importantly, it's the second large randomized trial that allowed patients on who had active or progressive brain mets. And as we move forward in designing these clinical trials, I think it's really important that we not exclude these patients because we are seeing them in our clinical practice, and we need data-driven information on how to appropriately manage them. So now as we move into the second section, focusing on brain metastases, it is important to just overall look at the incidence of brain metastases in breast cancer. We know that breast cancer is one of the most common causes of brain mets and leptomeningeal carcinomatosis. The incidence, depending on the series that you look at, is somewhere around 20 to, I would say, up to about 50% as you go down the various lines of treatment in HER2-positive disease. Fortunately, we have targeted treatments for our patients and they're doing well, but the other side of that is now they're living longer and they are developing brain metastases. And how we treat these patients, of course, depends on various factors. As shown here in the pie chart, you'll see 16% of the pie chart accounts for breast cancer in terms of brain metastases, and that has been pretty consistent but increasing over time. as we think of, again, how our systemic therapies are controlling systemic disease and allowing patients to develop brain metastases with time. As we think of some of the tools that we have in our toolbox for these patients, of course, we do have our surgical and radiation colleagues, and surgery may be appropriate for an individual patient, especially in a patient who presents with a single brain met or a few brain mets that are causing local edema, and they're very symptomatic. There may be a need to take them to the OR. They may not have any other sites of systemic disease. And we know that certain patients do very well with aggressive local therapy approaches long-term. So these should certainly be considered. And then, of course, the really important information that we can get if we get the pathology from that brain met, with some studies indicating that the information from that pathology in terms of genes that are expressed, the gene expression profile of these tumors in the brain may be different than what is in the systemic sites. So I think those would be reasonable reasons to consider surgery in the appropriate patient. But I do think that we are now utilizing other local treatments like radiation more frequently, and our radiation oncology colleagues tell us about how their treatment modalities have improved. And of course, we always try to avoid whole brain radiation therapy and utilize SRS when possible for up to 10 lesions. And that number seems to always be going up because, of course, we know the toxicities of whole brain radiation and how that can be tough for not only patients, also their families, as they see some of the neurocognitive decline that can occur, which is really hard for patients and their families to go through. And fortunately, on the medical oncology side, we've made consistent progress in treating patients with brain metastases with systemic therapies. We see a new era of treatment of HER2-positive tumors with treating them with some of these newer agents like tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We've gone through the tucatinib data in the HER2CLIMB study. There are other smaller agents that are in development. And of course, now we have antibody drug conjugates. And what I'll share with you in the next several slides are some of the data that are really challenging this thought that these newer novel ADCs that are fairly larger molecules cannot get into the brain, because we are seeing some really robust and encouraging activity. Of course, that needs to be validated in larger randomized studies, but an early hint that these drugs do, in fact, penetrate the CNS, and you can see some pretty remarkable responses. But the overarching question of, is systemic therapy the best option for patients with brain mets and HER2-positive disease versus, you know, some of the local treatment options that I detailed, which one is a better strategy? Of course, we don't have randomized data to make those decisions, but we certainly do have several tools in our toolbox, so to speak. Now, as we look back at some of our data sets in terms of patients with brain mets specifically, I already showed you the data, the long-term data from CLEOPATRA, but adding the information about brain metastases, remember, this was a first-line trial, so there were very few patients that at baseline had brain metastases that went on. But what we saw was in the pertuzumab group, the incidence of brain metastases did not differ between the two groups as they progressed. But what we did see was that there was a significantly increased time to the development of brain metastases. So are we implying here that pertuzumab delayed the incidence of brain metastases or decreased the risk of brain metastases? No, I think the thought here is really that the systemic disease, again, was well controlled for a longer period of time, and then those patients ultimately developed brain metastases. And as we think of some of the other data sets, for example, we've gone through the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, which was that head-to-head comparison. Again, highlighted here for you on this slide is the information that here only 82 patients had clinically stable, previously treated breast cancer brain metastases were allowed. So the information that we have as far as patients that were treated with this drug in a large prospective study is not there, but we're going to go through some of the information that we do have on the efficacy of patients with treated with brain metastases and ADCs, specifically here at TDXD. We saw that progression-free and overall survival benefit that I already pointed out earlier with the DB03 data. But again, focusing on those patients that had these clinically stable treated brain metastases, the first take-home point on this slide is that this information is, of course, prognostic. Patients with brain mets don't do as well as patients who do not have brain mets. But the other take-home point here is the benefit, again, in patients with or without brain mets of TDXD as compared to TDM1. And that's illustrated for you here. Now, as far as the intracranial response per blinded independent central review, we have that information highlighted here. It's important to note that we had unknown previous radiation status for these patients, but we do see an intracranial overall response rate that is pretty impressive, 64%. Compared to 33% with TDM1, again, pointing to the activity of this agent in the brain. And then very importantly, there was this pooled analysis of TDXD in HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer patients with brain mets from all of these trials, DESTINY-Breast01, 2, and 3. And these data were presented last year at ESMO by Sarah Hurvitz. I'll just point out that, again, in DESTINY-Breast01, patients had to have clinically stable brain mets. In originally, the DESTINY-Breast02 and 3 trials did allow patients with active brain mets on. Then there was an amendment that did not allow them on. So we're talking about small numbers here, but you see all of the various trials, DB01, DB02, and DB03, and the comparator arm, remember, there was no comparator arm in DB01. It was a non-randomized single-arm phase 2 study. But you see the comparator arm highlighted here, the study design. And here we're looking at specifically patients with brain mets. And what did we see? Well, we saw this intracranial overall response rate of in the mid-40s, which, again, is a pretty impressive number to see, as compared to somewhere around 10 to 20% in the comparator brain met pool of patients, again, with that comparator arm being different depending on the trial. With DB03, it was TDM1, and with DB02, it was the lapatinib or trastuzumab. So again, here there's some encouraging data that in this pooled analysis, we see a response with TDXD. What about specifically CNS progression-free survival? Again, TDXD demonstrated a trend towards prolonged CNS progression-free survival over the comparator. You'll notice this huge difference in the curves in terms of untreated active brain mets versus treated stable brain mets. Remember, the comparators were different here. It's difficult with cross-study designs. What I would say is that there's a noticeably greater advantage in the untreated brain mets, but it's hard to make much of that. It's just more to recognize the activity that this ADC likely has in patients with brain metastases. So what about going forward, looking at this in a prospective fashion? Well, we do have some smaller data sets. Here we have a very small study of looking at the efficacy of TDXD in patients with newly diagnosed untreated brain mets or brain mets progressing after previous local therapy with prior exposure to trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and no indication for local therapy. You see the prior therapy, a large percentage of these patients, again, there are only 15 in the trial, had received prior TDM1. And what we see here is an overall response rate of 73.3%, which at first glance seems really high, but remember, these are small numbers. Look at the confidence intervals here, 48 to 89, but still a lot of downward bars here. And I think this is an early hint that we are potentially seeing activity here, and that's good news, of course, for our patients. Here you see the progression-free survival of 14 months with T-DXd in the Tuxedo one trial, and the extracranial response rates also illustrated for you on the bottom. And then, of course, we also have the DEBRA data. Now, this is a multi-cohort trial. It was an open-label, single-arm, multi-cohort phase 2 study of T-DXd. Here, we were looking at not only patients with HER2-positive disease, there were patients also with HER2-low disease. You see the various cohorts. There was an untreated brain met cohort. There was even a cohort 5 that had meningeal carcinomatosis. There was some data presented just recently at San Antonio. And we look at the primary endpoints of overall response rate intracranially for cohorts 2 and 3, with the primary endpoint cohort 1, 16-week PFS. So again, just focusing on intracranial response rates, what do we see? Again, very impressive, 44 to 50% in cohort 2 and 3. These are responses intracranially in the brain. And with patients with measurable intracranial or extracranial disease, you see, again, a very high overall response rates with manageable toxicity and maintained quality of life. We also have some real-world data. This was a Japanese study looking at patients that had T-DXd. We were looking to evaluate the effectiveness of patients in a real-world setting who had brain metastases or leptomeningeal carcinomatosis, symptomatic and asymptomatic patients, and again, both active and stable. This was a chart review. Again, the take-home point is you see these higher than expected numbers in the patients who were treated with T-DXd. Again, we have a small N. It's 51, but 54%, 62%, or 63% total intracranial overall response rate. So quite encouraging. As we put the smaller data sets in context to some of the other information that we have, and we look at this on the whole, there was a look at all of these trials and kind of summarizing what the response rates were across all of these studies. It was around 62% across the board with T-DXd, which is very reminiscent of that DESTINY-Breast01 overall response rate, that waterfall plot that I pointed out earlier, which showed the activity as a whole. So making the point that here there may be a very similar activity in the CNS for this antibody drug conjugate. Now, moving on, as we consider tucatinib, this was a very important study in terms of patients with brain mets, again, where we saw the confirmed overall response rate intracranially of around 47%. Here we have the largest data-driven approach for patients with brain metastases, as this trial really did have a large number of patients, approximately half, that had brain metastases. And we saw, again, that intracranial response rate of 47% in patients with brain mets. Here we see the updated updated overall survival in patients with active brain mets. Again, median OS was 9.1 months longer in the tucatinib arm, and then that's broken down by active as well as treated and stable brain mets. So clearly a very, very active agent for patients with brain metastases. So putting this all together, we have other drugs and combinations that are being evaluated. We see other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We had mentioned the NALA data and the neratinib plus CAPE combination, which is another available combination. Again, harder to justify the use of neratinib when we have this highly active tucatinib regimen. I will say that this idea of sequencing TKIs is also another area of interest. We don't know if there will be sequential activity of these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We do see some activity with T-DM1, but we're seeing really encouraging activity, as I pointed out, with T-DXd, and we will be hopefully seeing more information in a prospective fashion with T-DXd. As we think of how to optimally manage these patients with brain metastases, I would just point out the importance of multidisciplinary collaborative approaches. We now have options that I've highlighted that include local strategies as well as systemic therapies, and there are sort of pros and cons of all of these approaches. Of course, in patients with a smaller number of lesions, SRS may be considered, surgery may be considered in a specific patient, a larger lesion that's requiring immediate local control because there's edema and patients are very symptomatic, maybe a patient that you may consider for surgery up front, of course, in collaboration with our neurosurgical colleagues. If there's edema, that's certainly a factor. And then again, as I pointed out, the need for tissue sometimes can dictate a local approach. But as we move forward and making more and more advances in our systemic treatment, we know that HER2-positive disease is sort of one of our larger, greater success stories in treating breast cancer, and we've made considerable progress in even targeting brain metastases with some of the data that I've shown you. Certainly more work that needs to be done, but for those patients who have HER2-positive disease, now that we're developing agents that get into the brain, that may shift us towards considering more of a systemic approach, especially in patients that are asymptomatic, as we have agents that get into the brain and we can forego a hopefully whole brain radiation in certain patients. So as we close out this section of the discussion on brain metastases, the conclusions are shown for you that the incidence of brain mets in patients with HER2-positive disease is increasing. It's sort of a kind of paradox in a way, because as we're doing better for our patients and controlling their disease systemically, they're living longer, and that's great, but now we're seeing this increasing incidence of brain metastases. It's important that we always individualize our approach and making sure that we're taking into account, of course, the data, but also recognizing the importance of the patient's voice and what they want, and making sure that they're part of our treatment team, knowing that we would want to, for example, consider delaying radiation for as long as possible, specifically whole brain radiation. We are now seeing more and more encouraging data with T-DXd in patients with brain mets. There's promising efficacy in several trials. I showed you some information that showed that the intracranial response rate is in the range of somewhere of 50 to 70% for those patients with active brain mets. And there is evidence of activity as second-line therapy before T-DM1. We have the largest randomized data with the tucatinib regimen. It's a large randomized phase 2 trial, but of course, the challenge here, as we have both of these regimens available, is that there's no head-to-head comparison with T-DXd. Standardizing clinical trials of patients in this situation is an unresolved need. We're awaiting the DESTINY-Breast 12 trial, which is going to be our largest prospective study evaluating patients with active as well as stable brain metastases. As we think of this unmet need for our patients, we know that many patients lack resources and information about diagnosis, treatment, management, and survivorship of CNS mets. And with that in mind, I'll just call to your attention the mbcbrainmets.org organization. This is a one-stop resource hub for patients with brain mets, and they come together as a community to help support each other and provide specific information that's tailored to their needs. And again, there's a medical advisory board. All the information is vetted. So this is an important resource that I would encourage you all to consider sharing with your patients. Now, as we move into a discussion of new and emerging approaches with HER2 targeted therapy, I'll just point out a little hint of the future of what is possibly to come. And these are really exciting things to think about as we consider our newer generation of ADCs will not only be able to deliver one cytotoxic payload, but perhaps dual payload ADCs with non-overlapping toxicity. So basically polychemotherapy in one drug, which is really remarkable to think about. We know in ER-positive breast cancer, the importance of some of these newer agents like PROTAX, they're under investigation and are showing a lot of promise. But here is the potential to couple the degradation of proteins with antibodies with these newer generation antibody PROTAX conjugates. And then thinking of how we can utilize immune approaches, including immune-stimulating antibody conjugates, or ISACs. These agents have started to show some encouraging activity in HER2-positive disease. It'll be interesting to see if there's any synergy with checkpoint inhibitors or other drugs that we already utilize. And then, of course, the potential for radioimmunoconjugates. So it's remarkable to see that we are moving into a field where we may be able to use antibody-targeted, antibody drugs to target and deliver various different payloads beyond just chemotherapy. So that's encouraging to see and exciting. And then, of course, we also have in the pipeline tri-specific antibodies. These are agents that force that connection between the tumor and the immune system by targeting both HER2 and immune antigens. So this is, again, another important type of therapy to watch. Of course, there are other targets in HER2-positive breast cancer. They're shown for you here. HER3 is one where we've made a fair bit of progress with a HER3-directed monoclonal antibody where we've seen some data. But of course, there are other targets, and some of these have been successful in GYN cancers like folate receptor alpha, Nectin-4, and of course, there are others. So hopefully more targeted treatments for our patients with HER2-positive disease. As we think of all of the progress we've made, it's tempting, again, to consider in a very specific patient to give them a lot of our active agents and see if, for example, in de novo metastatic breast cancer patients that are HER2 positive, where we know a subset of these patients do very well for many, many years, is there the potential to even render them cured? So that's being investigated in the context of this trial called SAFO, intensifying first-line treatment for patients with de novo HER2 positive disease. And you see these patients go through these 12 weeks of our most highly active therapy and then being followed. So whether this will or will not be a successful strategy is something that we'll have to see. Again, this is a small kind of proof of concept study in a small number of patients, but would be really interesting to see this approach bear out. And then now we move into a comprehensive approach to decision-making, optimizing treatment selection and sequencing of HER2-targeted therapies with a focus on the guidelines. Now, here you see systemic therapy regimens for HER2-positive, unresectable, or stage 4 disease per NCCN. And I won't belabor this slide too much because we've already gone through the data sets that have informed these recommendations for THP or trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and a taxane in the first line setting based on the CLEOPATRA trial. In the second line, the majority of our patients will get trastuzumab deruxtecan based on the DB03 trial that we went through. There is the opportunity, especially in patients with CNS mets, to offer the HER2CLIMB regimen with tucatinib, trastuzumab, and CAPE in the appropriate second line patient, but the majority of patients will receive that therapy third line. What the role is of T-DM1, it's still something that I think we are all trying to grapple with, but it is a very well-tolerated ADC that we're all very familiar with, and certainly our patients are doing very well for many years, so having it available is still a good thing for our patients. And then you see fourth line and beyond, we have various options with the optimal sequence not being entirely clear. And so as I go through this algorithm, I sort of walked you through it already in the slide that we just looked at, how to make the decision in the second line, TDXD or tucatinib, trastuzumab, capecitabine, or tucatinib, trastuzumab, capecitabine. I think the majority of our patients will be getting TDXD. There may be an occasional patient who has a very high CNS burden that you may consider the tucatinib regimen second line. I think for most of us, we would be utilizing that third line and beyond. Of course, this question of the activity of TDM1 post-TDXD, we certainly have the information in the reverse, but will there be activity with TDM1 post-TDXD remains to be seen. And as we think of individualizing our treatment options in the fourth line and beyond, we have to, of course, consider various factors, including patient choice, prior toxicities from prior treatments, and again, having newer agents in the pipeline with more options, hopefully, to come. So now we'll move into the third and last module, case-based discussion, as we think of how we can apply some of the data that I've just taken you through into integrating an appropriate personalized treatment plan for a hypothetical patient here. So this is a 68-year-old woman who presented to clinic for newly diagnosed metastatic breast cancer. It's important to highlight her original history here. The original diagnosis was with a small node negative invasive breast cancer that was triple positive 4 years ago. Now, we know many of our patients with early stage HER2 positive disease are doing really well. In fact, the APT regimen, which is weekly paclitaxel trastuzumab for 12 weeks, followed by completion of trastuzumab to complete a year, has resulted in a really good efficacy outcomes for the majority of our patients in the early stage setting with these small node negative tumors, and they're doing well and cured. This woman went through breast conserving therapy and then lost to follow-up, which I think is a really, really important point in this case. She didn't receive any systemic therapy. So here we see sort of the natural history of this disease play out in that she developed metastatic disease. So even with a small node negative tumor, this is an aggressive cancer left untreated. And not unexpectedly, she returned 4 years later with abdominal fullness, right upper quadrant pain, and significant fatigue, and went to the emergency room where imaging revealed an enlarged liver with multiple solid metastases, elevation of transaminases, but synthetic function, coags, and bilirubin, and all of that was within normal. Biopsy was done appropriately at the first diagnosis. We always want to confirm the diagnosis of metastatic disease and recheck biomarkers, as those can change in a small percentage of patients. But here we saw the same tumor, ERPR positive, HER2. And importantly, she had no brain metastases at baseline. She had no symptoms. Again, this brings up the issue of should we be doing brain imaging first line? But in this situation, she's presenting initially and has a systemic disease that is considerable. So I think it would be a reasonable option. As we think of what treatment options we would recommend for frontline treatment, I think it's pretty clear based on the data that I shared with you that our regimen of a taxane, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab would be our recommendation. But again, as we think about some of the unique aspects of this case that may inform what we do, again, this woman didn't of return for follow-up. She was lost to follow-up. So I think it's really important to drill down on, you know, what are some of those factors that allowed this patient to be lost to follow-up? Were there some social factors? Did she not want to go through chemotherapy at that time because she was very worried about the potential for hair loss? Is that now different? Were there transportation issues? Were there other social determinants of health that may be at play here that could have impacted her inability to get treatment early on? Because I think some of those same factors could influence what we do. Certainly, a taxane, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab would be optimal, but if she's having issues with getting to the cancer center for weekly therapy. We may consider docetaxel every 3 weeks. We may consider subcutaneous trastuzumab, pertuzumab, that may be helpful. So again, individualizing the treatment is really important here. Of course, there is always the consideration for hormonal therapy and trastuzumab, pertuzumab. I would feel less comfortable with that approach given her marked involvement in the liver. But certainly if it came down to a situation where she said, I will not take chemotherapy, I would be willing to consider it. But again, this case I think is important because it highlights some of the nuances of decision making, and it's not always so clear when you have that person in front of you. What may be a textbook answer may not be applicable in terms of the patient in front of you. So we have varied the case a bit. What I'll point out on this slide that's different is now she develops, instead of just liver metastases, a brain MRI is done, and she's found to have a single 2-centimeter brain met. And we're asking you to consider what your frontline treatment would be for this patient now, and basically trying to drive home the question of, you know, how does brain involvement at presentation influence your choice of therapy. So what I would say is clearly here, what is dictating this woman's prognosis is her systemic disease. So I certainly would be moving quickly to get her on systemic therapy, but we certainly do need to address this brain metastasis. So I would be looking to engage with our radiation colleagues and our neurosurgical colleagues to figure out what the best local approach would be. It seems like radiation would likely be the option there. But clearly what's dictating her prognosis here is the systemic treatment. And I would start trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and a taxane if she was willing to consider and have that brain met get treated with some local therapy. Now, here we see some follow-up on the patient. She is able to take standard treatment of a dual antibody therapy and a taxane. And after 2 cycles, she's symptomatically much improved. This isn't unexpected, right? We see HER2-positive patients respond very quickly, and it's very gratifying as a physician to see these patients who come in really symptomatic and you're able to help them. After 4 cycles, she has a 70% reduction in tumor burden. After 6 cycles, a complete response in the liver. Quite remarkable. But then she develops moderate neuropathy as well as edema related to the taxane. Even if she didn't, I think many of us would be thinking of dropping chemotherapy after a sort of induction period, and many of our patients do well on HP alone for many, many years. At that point, she initiates an aromatase inhibitor concurrently with the HP, and that's something, again, in standard practice we're all doing. I will point out that there is a trial that's ongoing, the PATINA study, which is also looking to see if there is a benefit of adding a CDK inhibitor to endocrine therapy and HP in this setting as sort of a maintenance, which will be an interesting a study to follow. 20 months later, she develops progression in the liver. There's a new 1-centimeter metastasis. She also has lung metastases. And again, the question here is, which treatment options would you recommend for second line treatment of this patient? We went through the DESTINY-Breast03 data, which showed a remarkable median PFS of 28 months with T-DXd in the second line. And this would be the patient that I certainly would be thinking of utilizing T-DXd in the second line. Then you're asked to consider if the patient had no brain metastases at baseline, so that first initial presentation, but in the second line setting, she progressed not only systemically, but also in the CNS. So again, in that situation, of course, the tucatinib regimen is something that could be considered. I think this is not a cookie cutter approach. This has to be individualized. If the patient had a burden of disease that was still quite high systemically, here she has one one small liver met and lung mets. Is she symptomatic from those lung mets? I showed you some data showing that TDXD does have some activity that we're seeing in the CNS. It still may be a very appropriate option in the second line. But then it would be a very different situation if she progressed and the bulk of her disease was CNS and she was very symptomatic from that. That might be a patient that I would consider in the second line using the tucatinib regimen. So again, here it highlights the importance of individualizing our treatments for our patients. As far as brain imaging to help select the next line of therapy, these are some of the questions that we've asked you to consider. Of course, you know, the evidence or the guideline approach would be to not utilize brain imaging for patients that are asymptomatic. I will say that I think that was really formulated in a time where we didn't have active agents in the CNS. So again, not a guideline approach, but there are patients that I may consider doing brain imaging, even if they're asymptomatic. And of course, the TDXD-related nausea and vomiting, as I alluded to earlier, is something that I think we've gotten a good hold on as we think of using prophylactic antiemetics. The question of screening or scanning, rather, for ILD, I think this is something we're all grappling with as we have to understand the importance of catching this early. So in the clinical trials, scans were done every 6 weeks, and that becomes quite problematic in a real-world setting. In my practice, every 9 weeks or every 3 cycles, I've been doing that for at least the first year and considering moving it out to every 12 weeks beyond that. As we think of how to manage ILD, that last question that was posed to you, this is a really important slide and very informative for how we can detect and manage TDXD-related ILD, the 5S rules. So this is something that was shared by Dr. Paolo Tarantino, the 5S's: screen, scan, synergy, suspend treatment, and steroids. So this is a nice algorithm that just highlights how we can detect and manage this worrisome side effect, but we need careful patient selection is warranted before initiating TDXD, and screening continues during treatment. So we have to educate our patients, make sure that they're aware of the side effect, some of the subtle findings, signs, and symptoms that can be present. We need to follow with imaging, right? You can't find what you're not looking for. So recognizing the importance of routine screening CTs, synergize with our multidisciplinary collaborative team and getting our colleagues from ID, pulmonary involved once ILD is suspected so that we can go through appropriately a differential diagnosis. Most importantly, suspend treatment. And this is something that I think is extremely important even for patients with grade one, meaning no symptoms, just found on imaging. This guideline is different than what we're used to dealing with some other agents. So there is the potential to rechallenge depending on how long it takes for grade one ILD to resolve on imaging. But for grade two or beyond, you're supposed to discontinue. And I think that's something that we're not used to with some of the other agents. But in the interest of our patients, this is something that we have to be very mindful of. And of course, utilizing steroids. So as we finish the program, I'll just end with my key takeaways and a bit of a summary. We've made considerable progress in treating HER2-positive disease. This was one of our most aggressive subtypes, and now we have 8 targeted agents with multiple more in the pipeline to come. The patients with brain metastases, this represents an important area of research. Fortunately, we've made some progress with tyrosine kinase inhibitors and some early data showing us that even antibody-drug conjugates do have activity in the CNS. There are multiple novel therapies on the horizon. And as we design these clinical trials, it's important that we need to include these patients specifically with brain mets into our study designs, the importance of highlighting or individualizing rather treatment recommendations and utilizing the multidisciplinary team approach, I think is an important takeaway. And lastly, I'll end with the plea that we have to do our part as providers to help empower patients to be their own best advocates, to make sure that they're part of the treatment team, to educate them on the side effects of the therapies and help them navigate these risk-benefit discussions and help connect them to important advocacy organizations that are doing really great work. So thank you, and I appreciate your attention.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/MVX860. This activity is supported by independent educational grants from AstraZeneca and Daiichi Sankyo Incorporated.